Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, which is Friday, March 29th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Rachel. And we'll start off with this on the front page. Amazon fully operational. Fulfillment center employs 1,500 at Davenport facility. And this written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. E-commerce giant Amazon's robotics fulfillment center in Davenport is up and rolling. Local and federal elected officials, community members, and reporters on Thursday toured the six-floor facility that Amazon officials said employs about 1,500 people and utilizes about 5,000 robots. The new fulfillment center started taking in items using robotics in January, said Nate Rudy, the facility's general manager. The first customer order was packaged and shipped February 4th. The facility's official first day of operation was October 15th. Rudy said when they had about 20% of the facility operational and were continuing to recruit employees. Since February 4th, the facility has processed, packaged, shipped out about 4 million customer orders. At capacity, Rudy said, the facility will hold 32 million products, and currently the facility is about three-quarters full. March and April is more of a lull time for shipping, Rudy said, but business picks up around Prime Day in the summer and ahead of Thanksgiving and Christmas. Amazon plans to hire about 300 more people in the next month, along with temporary help for busy times. Local economic development officials have heralded Amazon's arrival in the Quad Cities since the announcement in 2021 that the e-commerce giant would build a facility just north of Interstate 80 and west of the Davenport Municipal Airport that would employ more than 1,000 people. Originally scheduled to open in 2022, Amazon delayed that start date until 2024. Amazon officials say they're hiring full and part-time positions starting at $17.50 an hour, with insurance coverage, retirement plan, paid parental leave up to 20 weeks, and tuition assistance. I was very impressed with the technology that's used in the facility itself. But then also the manager talked through the benefits package and the opportunity that's here for local constituents in employment, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, said. So I'm just really thrilled that Amazon chose to be here in the heartland and extend those opportunities to great Iowans. Ernst added she believed the wages would be very competitive. And it's actually a good thing when we can see competition in the workplace. You know, employers that are competing for those quality individuals, Ernst said. Five types of robots transport or package orders throughout the facility, including robotic arms that pick up packages and transport robots that use markings on the floor to ferry packages from one place to another. To start, nearby Amazon sellers send their packages to the fulfillment center in Davenport. The products arrive through bay doors and the boxing and cellophane are removed to be shipment ready for the customer, Rudy said. The items are put into yellow totes. The Davenport facility doesn't process or store items heavier than 50 pounds, which are transported around the facility on conveyor belts. Items are sorted by size and put into tall yellow boxy towers for storage. The towers, called pods, are at most 1,200 pounds and ferried around by small blue robots called H-drives, also called Hercules. Once they make it into a storage pod, they become sellable, Rudy said. Online shoppers can select the product they want online, and the item they select will be ferried to a picking station where the item is selected by an employee and put into a tote. It's routed then to either a single pack station, if the shopper buys just one thing, or a multi-pack station if the customer buys multiple items to be shipped in the same box. Then the customer's order is routed to the outbound ship dock, either by a conveyor belt or by robot. Entire floors are reserved for the boxy blue robots Amazon calls Pegasus. An employee scans a package, sets it on a platform on top of the robot, which then ferries the package to a chute to distribute it to other parts of the facility based on zip code or delivery route. It follows markings on the floor and sensors. Amazon officials said the robots help eliminate lengthy amounts of walking that employees at older fulfillment centers did. The area where the robots transport items to is sectioned off, and only employees with specific training are allowed to go on the floor, such as to pick up a dropped item. Those employees are required to undergo 80 hours of training and wear a sensor so that robots don't come near them. Then the packages are sent off to another sorting facility, or what Amazon calls a last mile facility. Rudy said the next closest Amazon facility to the Quad Cities were delivery facilities in Iowa City. Tammy Deshipper of Fairfield, Iowa makes and sells handcrafted metal jewelry on Amazon. She said she picked Amazon because it got her more eyeballs than other sites such as Etsy. You can buy direct from artists on Amazon, Deshipper said. DeShepper has been in business since 2002 and attended art festivals within a 15-hour drive radius. She said it was much easier for customers to come to her rather than to go to customers herself. I see the front-end view. I package everything, I put on the stickers, I send it to the warehouse, and then magic happens and people get it, DeShepper said. So it was cool to see what the magic actually looks like. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, Republican from Iowa, said she was impressed by the facility's impact on small business owners. For those that want to be outside of manufacturing, distribution, service economies, there's an avenue for small business, Miller Meeks said. And so I think you're going to see a spirit, innovation spirit, entrepreneurship, because the facility is located here. So there could be upward pressure on wages. But I think what young people especially will see is an avenue to come into the workforce in different capacities at entry-level wages, and then a place where they can move up without having to move out of the state.
Also on the front page, local agency worried. Mississippi Bend AEA Quad City School Boards react to overhaul, and this is written by Olivia Allen. A bill to revamp Iowa's area education agency funding will take partial effect next school year, spurring some concern and caution for local Mississippi Bend AEA leaders and staff. The signing of House File 2612, I think, will forever change the system we've had for a long time and how we deliver services to children, families, and educators in Iowa, said John Speer, who is the chief administrator of the Mississippi Bend AEA. I don't think there's any way to deny that. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed House File 2612 into law on Wednesday, a day after it passed through the state Senate. The state's nine AEAs oversee special education and provide consulting services to school districts in their areas. Mississippi Bend AEA's service area covers roughly 55,000 students, including public and accredited non-public schools on the Iowa side of the Greater Quad Cities area. Speer continued, I think I can confidently say that HF 2621 will have a negative impact on every school district and their ability and our ability to deliver services. This bill, I believe, will be less equitable, more expensive, and more chaotic. The new law will require schools to spend 90% of their special education funding with the AEAs, while 10% could be used to contract services through a third party. Now, federal and state special education funding goes directly to the AEAs, which also receive property tax funding for media and other educational support services. Roughly 70% of Iowa's AEA funding goes toward special education services, and agencies have a 5% administrative spending cap. By the 25-26 school year, funding for media and other education services will go directly to the school districts, which will then have the option to spend it with the AEAs or an outside agency. Per the law, the Iowa Department of Education will also create a new special education division and a task force to study the AEA system structure and funding. Mississippi Bend AEA leaders are now focused on earnestly trying to figure out the bill's potential implications to gauge how the agency will respond. Mississippi Bend AEA plans to maintain existing staff levels for the 24-25 school year, Spear said, but will need to right-size staffing starting in the 25-26 school year. He said, "We're going to take a more cautious approach and use some reserves to keep us where we need to be for the next year," and added, "Mississippi Bend AEA must legally issue employment contracts by next month. Then we'll make decisions in a reasonable, rational manner." Possible disparities to rural Iowa school districts has been a common concern with the AEA reform bills, and Spear agrees. As more of the money goes to the districts and AEAs have less ability to spread staff around their entire footprint, I think it will be harder for rural districts to find staff in certain areas, he said, and harder for us to find staff to work in rural areas. This, in turn, could increase competition between Iowa public schools, pitting them against both the AEAs and each other, Spear said, including potentially having to outbid each other for staff. While private sector competition is nothing new for Iowa public schools, Spear said historic underfunding often forces districts to make really difficult decisions, such as budget cuts, school closures, or layoffs. Aside from AEA changes, the bill also includes a 2.5% school supplemental aid increase and boosts Iowa's starting teacher and paraeducator pay, but for some, the amount falls short of what they say is needed. If we're just focusing on the SSA, 2.5% is still below the inflation rate, Spear said, adding that this also applies to the past 4 or 5 school years. Low SSA actually increases property tax in districts. The lower the SSA, the more districts go on a budget guarantee plan, he said. While some Iowa superintendents were in favor of the AEA reform bills, wanting more control over their district's special education funds, most local school boards opposed these proposals. On February 26, for example, the Davenport School Board unanimously passed a resolution supporting the current structure and asking for a comprehensive study before any changes were made. Earlier this month, Bettendorf School Board Director Richard Lynch had similar concerns with the fast-tracking of bills. To him, if lawmakers thought large-scale, systematic AEA changes were needed, they should have conducted a study first. Bettendorf Board Directors Andrew Champion and Linda Smithson agreed, saying the impact of proposed AEA bills could be astronomical and detrimental for Bettendorf schools. Still, opinions on the Bettendorf School Board varied, with some members feeling changes to Iowa's AEA system might be necessary. Board Vice President Paul Castro supports the streamlining and condensing of Iowa's AEA system and thought Reynolds considered plenty of input and data to drive reform proposals. To strike a balance, Board President Patrick Larkin suggested mailing a letter to the Iowa State Capitol detailing Bettendorf school leaders' concerns with the AEA bill, a move that earned unanimous approval. The law's implementation timeline was one of the more disappointing components of File 2612, Speer said. Implementation under the original House bill would have mostly started in July of 2025, but the bill signed Wednesday bumped it up to July of this year. This makes it hard for AEAs, along with school districts and families, to plan and make reasonable decisions in wake of the new law, Speer said. The passage of a bill is one thing, but there will have to be hundreds or thousands of rules written around this bill, he said. I'm not sure the Iowa Department of Education has the capabilities, nor would any agency, to write the rules necessary to implement this piece of legislation by July of 2024. This dilemma will be difficult for AEAs and school districts to manage, Speer added. So that's a great concern of ours, he said. If you don't know what the rules are in the playing field, how do you go about doing business? In an earlier statement, Reynolds said national and state data shows significant proficiency gaps for students with disabilities in Iowa. She said while the AEAs will continue to serve students with disabilities, changes are necessary to improve student outcomes. A comprehensive review of AEAs will help identify solutions. Parents can be assured that their children will continue to receive the services they need. Speer said he couldn't see anything in House File 2612 that actually sought to increase test scores. So if that was the problem, I don't think this is the solution, he said. To Speer, positive student outcomes are more easily achievable when the AEAs, local school districts, and Iowa Department of Education work together. It's a three-legged stool, he said. I don't think the law in any way signals a process where those three work together. We shouldn't be adversarial. We shouldn't have to be adversarial. For example, Iowa was ranked 8th nationwide in computer science education, programming facilitated by the AEAs. The programming came about after a state request for proposals from companies came back higher than expected, Speer said. Instead, the AEAs were able to provide the training for virtually free. That is a clear example of when districts, the AEAs, and the Department of Education work together. We can do amazing things, Speer said. At a Pleasant Valley School Board meeting in January, Gina Kakavas, a speech-language pathologist for Mississippi Bend AEA, spoke against proposed reform bills. She's worked as a Pleasant Valley SLP since 2019 and is also a district parent. She said, for our non-speaking students, I'm able to get them communication devices to trial within days, Kakavas said. Private providers will take weeks to months to do that. Excuse me, just a moment, that's my phone. I apologize, friends. She's worked as a Pleasant Valley SLP since 2019 and is also a district parent. For our non-speaking students, I'm able to get them communication devices to trial within days. Kakavas said private providers will take weeks to months to do that. She also spoke to the benefits of the AEA-provided professional development training. As a parent, I want my children to have hands-on learning materials. The AEA makes this possible to our districts without having to come up with additional funding, Kakavas added. Using PV's robotics and STEM kits, digital instruction resources, and elementary Star Lab lessons. To his point, Tony Hyatt, director of elementary education, said subcontracting for consulting services Pleasant Valley currently receives from MBAEA would be a tremendous expense. Speer, too, warned that districts may face additional expenses with other contractors. Most services would be more expensive if they're provided by someone other than the AEA, Spears said, noting that the Mississippi Bend AEA solicited this information from companies that outsource services. Regardless of how the impacts shake out, Spear is deeply grateful for the thousands of AEA advocates for their support this legislative session. The support, quite frankly, was overwhelming. Although the bill did not turn out how we would have hoped in every aspect, their advocacy made a difference, he said. The bill is better today than it was on January 10th because of their efforts, and we are unbelievably appreciative.
Thank you, Rachel. This article caught my attention. I'm a coffee lover, and Awake expands into Iowa. Rock Island coffee business crosses the Mississippi. This written by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. A new option for coffee just opened on Brady Street. Awake Coffee Company has expanded into Iowa to include a new store at 4320 North Brady Street. The new shop, which neighbors the new Davenport Fire Department building, shares the building with Hot Works and Boundaries Mind Body Wellness. Brianna Holman, manager of the Davenport location, said the company opened its original location at 1430 4th Avenue in Rock Island in 2019. Talks about expanding into Iowa have been in the works for the past 2 years, prompted by requests from customers. We get a lot of business with the courthouse and the police department being down there, she said of the Rock Island location. But a lot of our customers would come in and ask us when we're going to Iowa because a lot of them come from Davenport. The decision to move on to Brady was all about the location, she said. Although the Quad Cities has no shortage of coffee shops, not many of them have the long hours and offer food like Awake does. In addition to the traditional coffee and energy drinks, Awake offers smoothies, protein shakes, pastries from Old Town Bakery in Moline, and $5 breakfast sandwiches with options like chorizo, egg, pepperoni, and Swiss, or bacon, egg, sausage, and cheese. For customers coming later in the day, Awake offers 5 different panini options for $7 apiece, including turkey, spinach, and provolone, and grilled ham and cheese. Holman said all of the options were made to order and could be customized depending on what the customer preferred, and the entire menu is offered all day. Awake is open from 7 a.m. until 9 p.m. on Sundays, from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday to Saturday, and the drive-through is open until 8:45 p.m. daily.
This from Rockford. Man is facing 11 charges for attack. This is written by Caroline Kubzanski of the Chicago Tribune. Authorities have announced charges against a 22-year-old Winnebago County man after a stabbing rampage that killed 4 and wounded 7 others Wednesday afternoon in Rockford. Christian Soto was charged, Rockford officials said at a Thursday news briefing, and faces 11 charges of murder and attempted murder and 2 charges of home invasion with a dangerous weapon, according to Winnebago County Sheriff records. Court records show Soto lives about a block from where he allegedly attacked 11 people, killing 4, including a mail carrier, in a southeast Rockford neighborhood. Rockford Mayor Tom McNamara identified the dead as Ramona Schupbach, age 63, Jacob Schupbach, age 23, Jay Larson, age 49, and Jenna Newcomb, age 15. Early Thursday, Craig Garr stood in his driveway in that neighborhood and watched a tow service load his Jeep Grand Cherokee onto the bed of a truck. Blood still splattered his driveway. It was on his door frame, on his yard decorations, and especially on two rocks that were usually by his front door, but on Thursday were lying near a set of deep tire tracks on his front lawn. He is 74 and has lived on Winnetka Drive for 45 years. Gar's mail came early Wednesday afternoon. It was two pieces. Just after the letters came through the slot, Gar said he was in his computer room and heard a commotion like a garbage truck. I looked out my window and I saw a guy hovering by my window. And then I saw the mail guy down there and he was just beating the expletive out of him, he said. And I said, "What are you doing?" And the guy said, "He stole money from me." Then the letter carrier, Larson, rolled over. He recognized Gar. He said, "Call 911. Gar said the man beating up the mailman saw he had the phone in his hand and made for the front door. Gar shut and bolted the door so he couldn't get in the house. From his window, Gar said he saw the man continue to attack the mailman before getting in a black truck. He floored it, like down to the ground, and ran over the mailman, Gar said. Smashed my car. Then he put it in reverse and backed over the mailman in my yard. He did not sleep Wednesday night. Residents in the area on Wednesday night feared for the lives of their neighbors and mourned the neighborhood's popular mailman. Rockford Police Chief Carla Redd confirmed that a mail carrier had been involved in the massacre and the U.S. Postal Service had a representative at the scene Wednesday evening. Tracy Smith spent much of the night poring over video footage from her home doorbell system, her dog pacing at her feet. She played back a snippet of tape from 12:55 p.m. over and over, watching a figure cross the screen. "Yep, that's him," she said. Smith, age 56, has lived near the intersection of Cleveland and Holmes since the late 1990s and said the mailman had worked the block for years. He would smile and wave at the front door even if he couldn't see someone in the home, she said. Rockford Alderman Mark Bonney of the 14th observed that residents of the area would be likely to know their mail carrier well. "This neighborhood still has door-side mailboxes, so the mail carrier walks the route and is on your doorstep every day." A vigil honoring the victims was planned for Thursday afternoon.
All right, we have a couple minutes here. I'll try to get through this article. This comes from Clinton, written by Jenna Blount of the Clinton Herald. Apartments ordered to vacate, residents ordered to leave by May 1st. Residents of apartments at a former U.S. Army hospital campus in Clinton have until May 1st to vacate because the buildings have been deemed dangerous or are condemned. The Housing Board of Appeals decided at a May 6th hearing to uphold occupancy permit revocation and a notice to vacate served on Lions Creek Apartments at 2604 North 4th Street. "This is our fault," said Danny Nijem, representing the apartment complex at the hearing, "and we are paying dearly for these mistakes for hiring the wrong people. Tenants have been given until May 1 to vacate. They are to be assisted by the city in finding alternative housing." According to the minutes of the hearing, the property includes 18 buildings intended to be utilized for apartments. Only four of the buildings, though, are occupied and three have been condemned. The remaining buildings have been declared to be dangerous. On February 19th, Lions Creek Apartments received the order to vacate all buildings on the property from Lynch Dallas Law Firm out of Cedar Rapids. Lions Creek Apartments responded with a letter of appeal asking for more time to remediate violations of the city code. "I know we were late on a few things and we've had a lot of issues finding a property manager that will stay at the property because the building is not generating any money," Nijem said. "It's been too difficult to invest in the property when the property doesn't have as much demand as we anticipated. If all violations are abated, the property passes an inspection and it's approved by the city, Lions Creek may apply for a new occupancy permit at any time. and the revocation may be extended beyond a year, though if the property continues to remain in violation of city code.
Thank you, Jim. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. There are a number of pending notices and then one brief obituary. The pendings include Paul A. Bonney, age 79, of Davenport, died on Monday, March 25th. Arrangements are pending at the Runge Mortuary. Geraldine, or Jerry Heights, age 66, died Friday, March 28th. Arrangements are pending at the Van Ho Funeral Home. Richard A. Hoffman, age 73, of Dixon, died on Wednesday, March 27th. Arrangements are with the Wirtz Funeral Home. Mary Meyer, age 86, of Bettendorf, passed away Tuesday, March 26th. Arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory. William M. Miles, age 77, of Moline, died on March 28th. Arrangements pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory in Moline. Sandra Sharp, age 83, of Comanche, died on Tuesday, March 26th. The Lemke Funeral Home is assisting the family. Jack Wickelman, age 87, of Davenport, died on March 26th. Arrangements are pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home. And Gregory Young, age 69, of Rock Island, died Saturday, March 23rd. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline. And there is one short obituary coming from Johnston, Iowa. Sister Jeanette Koppel, CHM. Sister Jeanette Koppel, or Mary Renee, CHM, age 90, died at Bishop Drum Retirement Center in Johnston, Iowa, on March 26th. She has donated her body for medical research. Memorial Vespers will be at 4 p.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, in Our Lady of Peace Chapel at Bishop Drum in Johnston. Also Tuesday, April 2nd, in the Magnificat Chapel at the Humility of Mary Center, a rosary will be held at 4 p.m., and a memorial vigil service will happen at 7 p.m. It's time now to turn to the opinion page.
Thanks, Rachel. And we have an article here written by Froma Harrop. She lives in New York City in Providence, Rhode Island, and writes for Creators Syndicate. On which team exactly was McDaniel playing? Ronna McDaniel's conduct following the 2020 election was shocking enough. But NBC's decision to hire her as a paid political analyst almost topped it. The blowback from the company's own commentators prompted the executives to turn around and send McDaniel packing. The problem for NBC and its decidedly liberal MSNBC news channel wasn't that McDaniel headed the Republican National Committee. It wasn't that she supported Donald Trump's bid for re-election. It was that when Trump lost, she worked to overturn the results. There are misdeeds political players can explain away. Trying to overthrow our democracy shouldn't be one of them. What were the NBC bigwigs thinking? Almost as repellent as McDaniel's claims that the election was stolen was her excuse for knowingly lying about it. As she explained on NBC's Meet the Press, when you're the RNC chair, you kind of take one for the whole team, right? Now I get to be a little bit more myself. on exactly what team was McDaniel playing. It sure wasn't Team America. And given McDaniel's lack of character, her vow to be more myself was hardly reassuring. NBC political analyst Chuck Todd put it exactly right. In an interview with his Meet the Press replacement, Kristen Welker, he said, "I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. Is she speaking for herself, or is she speaking on behalf of who's paying her? The world is full of Ronna McDaniels, amoral individuals out for power and money with no concern for the greater good. To snag an estimated $300,000 a year gig with a big TV presence, she was willing to publicly state that the voters indeed chose Joe Biden as president. She didn't even bother denying that she knew that the stolen election business was baloney from the start. McDaniel is what she is. But what exactly is NBC News? We get that the network wants more conservative voices, even Trump supporters. But there were Republicans who weren't going along with the attempted coup, even as they backed Trump's reelection. McDaniel's uncle, Mitt Romney, is an honorable conservative, unafraid of drawing lines for decency, and thus willing to criticize Trump. So concerned was McDaniel of retaining Trump's trust in her servility that she dropped Romney from her name. She used to call herself Ronna Romney McDaniel. Really, what would be the use to NBC, or Fox News for that matter, of a political analyst who lacks a shred of conviction and is so cynically self-serving she didn't even think to hide it? As a pure business decision, this hire was inexplicable. Yes, the news show needs a wide range of views. Even MSNBC invites conservatives to the set, and most of its audience seems cool with it. But would the audience be cool with hiring a paid political analyst who tried her hardest to throw out their vote for president? Do the chiefs at NBC even know the serious incompetence behind their decision to employ McDaniel, someone who joined Trump on a phone call pressuring Michigan canvassers to reject the election results? There would have been massive boycotts of NBC News, never mind MSNBC. Do note that Todd and Joe Scarborough and other NBC, MSNBC commentators risked their contracts by publicly berating the parent company executives for their harebrained choice of an election denier as a political analyst. That goes double for taking on someone who knowingly lied about who won a presidential election, but also admits that she lied. Whatever team McDaniel is playing on certainly shouldn't have been Team NBC, not even for a day.
Another piece on the opinion page under the title of My View is titled What the Wolf Pack Can Teach Us About Ourselves. This is written by Eric Friedland, who writes for the Wisconsin State Journal. We live on the edge of nature. Our house in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, sits in a coulee of the Mississippi Valley, its foundation tucked into the base of the Mississippi River bluffs. All manner of wildlife encroaches on our yard and daily lives. Not long ago, a bobcat sauntered past our back window, nonchalantly glancing at us through the glass as if window shopping. My wife has a trail camera by which we can track the movements of deer, coyotes, and also two bobcats that have a den nearby. Moles tunnel their way through our backyard, constructing a subterranean subway system with numerous metro stations in our yard. On some nights, coyotes can be heard howling their territorial rights, a forlorn sound that echoes throughout the valley and through my body. Our dog Gil barks a reply while a tingling sensation shuttles its way to my core. The bark and the tingle have a common origin in our evolutionary past. Living on the edge of the woods allows nature to puncture that imaginary boundary and impact our lives in ways we cannot imagine. We are, after all, sons and daughters of nature. Our family tree extends far back in evolution and explains our basic instincts, made manifest in tingles and trembles. We are shaped by our instincts, but not beholden to follow them. The common expression, survival of the fittest, has been used to justify our most abhorrent behavior in warfare, politics, and society. Yet the expression, coined by philosopher Herbert Spencer, was not meant simply to describe our capacity to defeat an enemy, but rather our ability to adapt to our environment. Despite our longevity as a species, humanity has not adapted well. A long list of physical and verbal violence against our perceived enemies displays our inclination to ride our emotions rather than our intellect to confront problems, all of which complicates our chances of survival. Character matters in both nature and humanity. Author Rick McIntyre describes the social interactions of wolves reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park during the 1990s in his book, The Rise of Wolf 8. He chronicles the survival of wolf packs through the sharing of hunting and pup-rearing duties by its members. He writes, "For most predator species, the normal behavior for a new male would be to kill the young of the prior male, breed the female, then help raise the young he sired. In all cases, I later witnessed new alpha males helped raise the pups born to the previous male." To be sure, wolves do exhibit what we might consider abhorrent behavior. Yet in thousands of hours of observation, McIntyre describes the sociability and cooperation among members that we humans can emulate. He writes, "Nearly everyone knows of a family with a big male dog who is gentle with toddlers and young children, even when they tug on the dog's ears and tail. That tolerance, along with the dog's desire to play with kids and protect them, comes directly from their wolf ancestors. For us, that big male dog is Gil, our golden retriever blessed with a golden personality and depth of character, teaches me tolerance and other virtues on a daily basis. In his sincere eyes, we find honesty, though on occasion he might trick you into thinking he's going to give back the stick you threw. And when he places his head in your lap, we find unconditional loyalty. As humans, we learn from our encounters with nature in all its forms. We feel the tingle of fear from predators. We experience joy from our animal companions. We sense anger from our human adversaries. We can learn from these experiences to project our best selves, a nurturing self as deeply rooted in us as any emotion. We answer a fundamental question with our response. Do we surrender to our baser instincts, or do we use our intelligence and self-awareness, unique to the human species, to rise above our predatory ancestors? We all live on the edge of nature, with the capacity to decide which qualities we gather from that relationship. The answer can be found somewhere beyond the tingle and the bark.
Thanks, Rachel. Staying with the opinion page, one more article, another view from the New York Times. Putin's Russia jails journalists for saying truth. Wall Street Journal, Radio Free Europe, reporters among 22 wrongly locked away. The Committee to Protect Journalists has documented that at least 320 members of the press were behind bars around the globe as 2024 began. In Vladimir Putin's police state, at least 22 journalists are jailed, most for committing the most elemental of journalistic duties, speaking the truth. Two of them are American reporters. One of them, Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal, will soon mark a year in the infamous Lefortovo prison, awaiting trial on charges of espionage. The other, Alsu Kermasheva, an editor for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, was arrested while visiting her mother and has been in detention since October. The charges against both are a travesty. Their incarceration is a violation of their rights and an assault on foreign journalists that is even more egregious than what transpired under Soviet rule. The Biden administration should continue to do all in its power to secure their freedom. Gershkovich, now 32, is not a spy, and his accusers know it. He is a reporter, a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, who worked in Moscow with official accreditation from the Russian government until he was taken prisoner by a secretive police unit in Yekaterinburg on March 29, 2023. The reason for the arrest may be known only to Putin. Perhaps it was to send a signal that foreign correspondents are no safer from the reach of the Kremlin's police than Russian reporters. For some time now, and especially since the invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, the Kremlin under Putin has dealt ruthlessly with any opposition, as demonstrated most starkly by the sudden death last month of Alexei Navalny, Putin's most prominent opponent. Kermasheva, a dual Russian and American citizen, lived with her husband and two daughters in Prague and worked there as an editor. She traveled to the Russian city of Kazan last May to visit her ailing mother, but was prevented from leaving, purportedly for failing to register her American passport. On October 18th, she was detained for failing to register as a foreign agent, and she has been held since. Her husband, Pavel Buterin, has said he suspects the new case involves a book that Kermasheva and her colleagues co-edited called Saying No to War, 40 Stories of Russians Who Oppose the Russian Invasion of Ukraine, a collection of radio interviews with Russian people who express their anti-war feelings in different ways. Opposing the war is a crime in Russia. Journalists in Russia who are working to break through the obstacles and traps Putin has set are performing a critical service in shedding light on the authoritarian and expansionist project. He fears them for a reason, and for that same reason they deserve the unflagging support of all those who cherish freedom.
And it's time to turn to the sports page. First, a few things on this weekend on TV. Iowa Hawkeyes women basketball, of course, play their next game in the NCAA tournament versus Colorado Saturday at 2:30. Chicago Cubs are playing this weekend, the Rangers, on Saturday and Sunday at 6:05 and 1:35, and the Rockies on Monday at 1:20. The Cardinals play the Dodgers today and tomorrow, at 9:10 and 8:10 p.m., and then Sunday at 6:10. The Chicago White Sox playing the Tigers on Saturday and Sunday at 1:10, and the Braves on Monday at 1:10. Basketball, the Chicago Bulls at the Nets today at 6:30, at the Timberwolves Sunday at 6, and versus the Hawks on Monday at 7. Chicago Blackhawks versus the Flyers Saturday at 6, and at the Islanders Tuesday at 6:30. Quad City Steam Wheelers versus Green Bay on the 6th, and versus Frisco on the 13th and Massachusetts on the 20th. The Quad City Storm versus Peoria today, Saturday, and April 5th, all times at 7:10. And the Quad City River Bandits versus South Bend, that comes up on April 5, 6, and 7. First two games are in the evening, and April 7th is at 1 p.m. And going to the front page of the sports section, Illinois Prep Softball, the Rock's Edge Maroons. This is by Samir Mala. Moline and Rock Island needed extra innings Thursday to settle their game at Francis Willard Field. The Rocks won 2-1 on a walk-off sacrifice fly by catcher Josie Kerr in the bottom of the ninth inning. "We fought hard and dug deep in this game," Rock Island head coach Julie Hudnall said. "We did not give up. We kept battling and competing, and that is all we can ask for my kids." Kerr, on the fourth pitch of her fifth at-bat of the day, hit a fly ball that drifted into foul territory past the left field foul line with one out in the ninth inning. Moline left fielder Kaylee Dennis made a sliding catch. Alrion Lonergan, who walked on five pitches to start the inning, tagged up from third base for the game-winning run. That is one of those players that Moline are going to talk about. Dennis is going to learn a lesson right there, Hudnall said of Dennis's sliding catch in foul territory. Fortunately, the game went our way. "That was a tough, tough way to lose there," Moline head coach Jordan Wages said. "We told Dennis at the end of the game that play probably happens once a season, maybe. That is just a simple IQ play. We cannot catch that foul ball because the runner is going to tag and score. If that play ever comes up again, she will never make the same mistake. That is just a weird play that hardly ever happens." Unfortunately, that was the difference in the game. The Rocks, who are 3-1 and 1-0 in Western Big Six, stayed in this extra inning affair mainly due to their defense. Time and again, they made defensive gem after defensive gem to keep the Maroons from scoring the go-ahead run. One defensive highlight during regulation happened in the top of the fifth inning, with Rock Island up 1-0. After a single by Dennis to open the inning, a sacrifice bunt by Maroons pitcher Kaylee Reynolds moved Dennis to second base. The fourth batter of the inning, second baseman Ava Navarro, hit a ground ball to center. The ensuing relay from center fielder Lonergan to starting pitcher Maddie Carroll, then to Kerr, resulted in a bang-bang play at the plate. Dennis was tagged out by Kerr to keep the Rocks ahead, heading into the sixth inning. Lonergan threw out the runner at home from center field, and we had both Mallory and AJ make plays at the middle positions, and our first baseman Grace dug some throws out, Hudnall said of the defensive plays made by her infielders. Elena Kress made a great play at third base to get the lead runner out at second in extra innings. They were doing things that they were supposed to keep us in these softball games. Rock Island played a really good game, Wages said. I do not think they made an error, and they really made us work for our runs. We had one run off a home run, and we did need to figure out a way to get a couple of more runs across the plate with runners in scoring positions. But this is only our second game of the season. One positive takeaway for the Maroons, who are 1-1 and 0-1, who are playing their first WB6 game of the season, was starting pitcher Kaylee Reynolds pitched all nine innings, including the two extra innings. Reynolds threw 139 pitches, striking out seven Rock Island batters while walking four and allowing only two runs in a complete game effort. Wages said Reynolds threw a great game. She was just locked in the whole time. We held Rock Island to just two runs, and that's really, really good. At the plate, catcher Elena Diaz kept the Maroons in the game. Her solo home run to center in the top of the sixth inning leveled the game at 1-1 as part of a 2-for-3 performance. Diaz also hit a double in the top of the third inning and drew a walk in the eighth. Rock Island starting pitcher Matty Carroll allowed no runs through five innings on the mound, striking out six and only walking one batter. At the dish, she went 2-for-4 and had the first RBI of the game in the third inning for the Rocks, who host Biggsville, that is 3-0, on Monday. "We got to keep playing and keep playing for each other," Hudnall said. "That is the biggest thing right now, using this momentum to take us back, to take us into the next week's softball, so it'll be fun." The Maroons host fellow WB6 Alleman Pioneers, who are 3-5 and 0-1 on Tuesday. "I am looking forward to watching my team perform in conference play," Reynolds said. "This is an extremely fun conference to play in because it is so competitive. It is going to be a battle, and we are looking forward to that this year." Well, we are very close to ending our time with the Quad City Sports. One short little sport notes. Six Augie Cagers are honored. Six Augustana College basketball players, four from the women's program and two from the men's, were named to the College Sports Communicators Academic All-District Team. Emma Berg, Linnea Johansson, Callie Papez, Corey Whitlock, Mike Hamilton, and Chase Larson were honored. And Iowa has placed gymnastics coach Larissa Libby on paid leave as an investigation into the program is done. Phil Cantanzano, co-founder of the Education and Sports Law Group, will conduct the review. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.